coach.
Yeah, I'm going to meet with him just after my exam on the 18th of January, hopefully.
He's not old enough to have been involved in the beginning. Joe, I think, is about 82.
Okay.
Thereabouts, so he would have graduated probably in the 40s. Probably.
Okay.
And the thing was well underway by then. So I recall, I think it came in the 30s.
I have a source saying that the Workers' Association that they had then talked about it in the 1880s, but
yeah.
I don't know exactly when.
When it came in.
When it came
I think
in,
it was
exactly,
in the
30s. Yeah. It was in the 30s.
As checkoff, that is.
Yeah.
As a,
mandatory kind of.
The system of checking off
mm-hmm.
was well established for other things.
Mm-hmm.
And they checked off for supplies.
Mm-hmm.
So they could buy their supplies at the company store.
Mm-hmm.
It was taken off their pay, so they were used to this sort of thing. And it started with a hospital checkoff, and then was extended to physicians.
Okay.
The hospital checkoff, I think, started fairly early, even earlier than that, quite a bit earlier than the other. I'm surprised. Did you read the book by Paul McKeown? Is there anything in there?
I have that at home still, and I haven't found very much on it, because he doesn't actually specifically talk about that in one section. So.
No, he's more interested in the fights between
yeah.
the company and the unions.
I have to do a bit more research, though, because I haven't found very much so far.
Well, it was, I suppose that when it started, it was a big advance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was recognized as a major advantage working in the mine, and was an incentive actually for young men to go into the mines. The fact that they would not only have a pension, but that they and their families would have health care.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, when all physicians were essentially undifferentiated. The general practitioners did their own surgery and their own obstetrics. And, there were very few specialty trained physicians in the province. The advantages were far greater than they subsequently were because they got their surgery, their obstetrics, pediatrics, everything was looked after essentially by the doctors who in the same towns
mm-hmm.
were supplying the same services to everybody else but at a fee. So, and this was a fairly nominal fee.
Really?
It was, when I was there, it was $1.25 a week, which was in the 60s.
To stay in the hospital?
No, that was the checkoff.
Oh, for the checkoff.
Yeah, so it cost them about $75 a year for complete health care.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you bought insurance with Great West Life, who provided similar coverage, or Maritime Medical, it was hundreds of dollars.
Really?
So it was a big differential to get it through the mine. And the reason was that the company supplied, as far as I recall, matched whatever the miners gave.
Okay,
so
did you want to answer that?
No.
Okay.
When it first came in, essentially everybody in a mining town got the same care from the same doctors, but it was paid differently. It was
mm-hmm.
paid fee for service or through private insurance for the average citizen and for the miners, it was this panel medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It began to show signs of strain when specialization began, and the
when would that have been?
That would have been in the 20s, late 20s. The Royal College was, I think, founded around 1929, so there. subspecialties by then, but they wouldn't have been large numbers of them outside of Montreal and Toronto.
Okay.
But there were some here in Halifax that were fully trained surgeons. I don't think there were any in Cape Breton who
no.
could claim to be specialty surgeons. That's all they did. The same for obstetrics, and certainly there were no specialists in pediatrics outside of the Halifax. So at that point it wouldn't have made any difference because
mm-hmm.
the surgery was being done by the same people whether you were a minor or not. What tended to happen, of course, was that in the non-mining towns, specialization came in and began to develop. But it was impossible in the mining towns because the majority of people in the mining towns were miners.
Okay.
And they didn't want it. They didn't want to pay over and above what they were paying their doctor. Felt the doctor should do everything.
So when you were there, there were no specialists?
Oh, there was this one specialist.
Okay.
There was a general surgeon who was fully trained, Royal College Fellowship, but he also did general practice.
Okay.
And in fact, I think he had the largest of the general practices as well. And so what the way it evolved was that people who had an interest in an area would develop it.
Okay.
So everybody did everything, but there were four of the six physicians, Clace Bay when I was there, who did anesthesia.
Okay.
Now the anesthetics were pretty crude. They were open drop ether. No one knew how to intubate a patient. Or if they did, they certainly didn't have the equipment to do so. Patients got into ventilatory problems, they couldn't rescue them. They were using ether instead of modern anesthetics because ether was safe, reasonably safe, although ether has a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using some cyclopropane, which was explosive.
How would that compare with Sydney and Halifax and other?
Well, in Sydney, when I was there, they had a fully trained anesthetist.
Okay.
Who were certainly far better trained than the general practitioners. Joe Roach
mm-hmm.
in New Waterford, who was a general practitioner, had had some training in anesthesia, and he taught the other mining town doctors to do anesthetics. They'd go over and spend a few weeks with Joe. Go over in the mornings when he was giving anesthetics. But again, it was very, very elementary and wasn't getting any better, whereas everybody else was evolving.
Mm-hmm.
The same was true for surgery. The surgeon who was there in Glace Bay was quite remarkable, technically, intellectually, and in every other way. But if he didn't do all the
mm-hmm.
surgery, they had the GPs doing a lot of their own surgery. So they were reasonably good at what they did, and they tried to limit themselves. But if he was away or was unavailable, then they would turn their hands to it. So and there was no urology. The
mm-hmm.
general surgeon did the urology. He did all the gynecology. All the complicated obstetrics, and you know, they were fortunate. You know, over in New Waterford, they had one fully trained surgeon, Danny Matheson, and a fellow that had 2 years of surgical training, who stayed a few years and
mm-hmm.
then came back to or went to New York to finish his surgical training. But it was roughly the same over there, whereas in Sydney, which was actually no bigger than Glace Bay in terms of population, they started to attract people in specialties. So they had a gastroenterologist, and they had a pediatrician, and they had pathologists and anesthetists. And so although the care that people in Sydney got was probably not a great deal better than in Glace Bay, it was starting to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
They would have left Glace Bay far behind if it wasn't for the advent of Medicare,
mm-hmm.
at which point everything changed. They were now able to recruit other surgeons and internists, and so overnight things changed dramatically in Glace Bay. But up till then, plus it was the doctors were overworked because you couldn't employ anybody else unless they convinced 600 miners to come on their panel,
mm-hmm.
which meant they had to leave the other doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And the mines, beginning after the war, began to decline in number of workers.
Mm-hmm.
So the population wasn't changing much, but the pie was getting smaller. And so it was hard to convince the six that had the place that they should recruit anybody else, because it would have cut their incomes.
Mm-hmm. So how did a new doctor end up coming in then?
They didn't.
Never.
It was closed shop. When somebody left or retired, they could bring somebody else in, or died. That was the only way to get another doctor
mm-hmm.
in, because they were willing to split it six ways, but they weren't willing to split it any more than that.
Were they recruited if a new doctor was to come in, or?
They recruited, they were. They could come in and set up shop. There wasn't anything to prevent them from
mm-hmm.
coming. But if you weren't on the checkoff, then it meant you couldn't look after miners and their families.
Mm-hmm.
So you were restricted to people who weren't miners. And that was a little chancy. There was a doctor who was not on the checkoff. I remember him, Cater was his name. I don't know what the arrangement was, but he sure wasn't making a living.
Really?
He lived almost poverty stricken, but he seemed to have no interest in it. He stayed until he died. And the other practitioners practiced without exception, I should say, with one exception, they practiced until they died.
Really?
Or were forced to retire by illness or infirmity, so that they practiced into their 70s, and Joe Roach is still going in his 80s. And there were a couple of people in Glace Bay. Nicholson was certainly in his 80s when he retired. So it was a different time, different group of people, different attitudes towards medicine.
Why would the doctors stay if they weren't the best working conditions or the best health care?
Force of habit. It wasn't a great deal better elsewhere.
Okay.
Physicians were poorly paid in Nova Scotia, outside Halifax,
mm-hmm.
and the South Shore. 30% of people paid their doctor in eastern Nova Scotia, 70% didn't. So 70% of whatever.
Okay, sorry, it's working. I'm a little skeptical now that it didn't work last time I used it.
Plus, most of them, as I recall, in fact, they were all from Glace Bay.
Would you say that patients in the mining towns like Glace Bay would have received better health care because they would have gone more often and
they
maybe had more?
They probably did in the days when all care was delivered by GPs.
Okay.
Once specialization began to occur in the non-mining towns, I suspect that the quantity might have been more, but the quality was less.
Okay.
In mining towns, that where this particularly diagnostic care was probably not up to standard, anesthetics were not up to standard. It would be hard to know because the most people don't realize how primitive medical care was everywhere, even
mm-hmm.
in the most sophisticated places. In the before the 1960s, I mean, there were very few antibiotics. There were no effective antihypertensive drugs. There were no diuretics. Pharmacopoeia was a slim little book that you could carry around in your coat pocket,
mm-hmm.
and half of that was useless. So the numbers of things you could do for people were not what we can do today, and I don't think not the population nor the current graduates realize how thin useful medical care was in those days. I mean, you think in the early 60s, there was no dialysis for renal failure, no way to treat renal failure, no open heart surgery, no even closed heart surgery. Closed heart surgery began here in the early 60s. So you couldn't do anything for patients with heart disease, you couldn't do anything for patients with strokes.
Mm-hmm.
So infections were the area, and surgical problems, bowel obstructions, hernias, and peptic ulcers were the cancers. So surgery could deliver for those things, but most, even the heart drugs, the only heart drug was digitalis,
mm-hmm.
which of course nobody uses anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to believe. So the differences that specialization would bring were modest in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if the Chekhov system had continued through the 70s, the differences would have been magnified.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem was that there was the doctors were overworked. They had their practices were too large. It was always, well, we have enough for six. We have more than patients than we can handle for six, but we haven't got enough for seven.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stretched to the nth. They were working unbelievable hours, and most of them never took a vacation. They never went anywhere. They were making house calls, 40 and 50 house calls a day, seeing patients in the hospitals. They might have 40 patients in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There were two hospitals in Glace Bay, each with about 150 beds.
And we both
did
work at both?
And they worked at both. Medical staff was the same. One was a Protestant hospital, or the public hospital, so-called, was really a Protestant hospital. And the other was a Catholic hospital. The medical staff was the same at both. And the average doctor would have 50 patients in hospital.
Really?
I can imagine a single doctor, no house staff, looking after 50 patients in hospital.
Wow.
So they were really stretched. They worked extremely hard, and as a consequence, there was no time for well patient care or for clinics where you looked after chronic disorders.
Mm-hmm.
There was virtually no care for the chronically ill, so no rheumatology, nobody looking after the arthritics, no diabetic clinics, no well baby clinics,
mm-hmm.
No vaccination programs. Kids got vaccinated, but only if they went to their family doctor. And he remembered that the child hadn't been vaccinated. So it was I think, probably substandard by the time the 60s came around.
Mm-hmm.
Probably substandard even in the 50s. But in the 30s and 40s, it was probably as good as you were going to get anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of problem that you get with systems like this. Nobody becomes aware of the inadequacies. They creep up.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're comparing one place with another or one system with another, you're not aware that you're falling behind. And the physicians were all well-read, and they subscribed to the journals, and they had case discussions and rounds and all the rest of it. But there was no fresh blood coming in constantly.
Mm-hmm.
The pathologist came from Sydney. I was there once a week. They had nobody to read the x-rays. They read them themselves, and then a radiologist would come around every week or every 2 weeks and read all the backlog. And if you missed something or made a mistake, you didn't catch it for a couple of weeks. They were pretty good at reading x-rays, but that's not quite the same as... And there was no interventional radiography of any kind. So.
Would they ever leave to update their skills? Go for more training outside of...
I'm not aware that any of them did, except for the surgeon, which was a charity hospital in those days and didn't charge anyway, so the patient didn't get billed, and it didn't come out of the checkoff because it was all covered. It wasn't covered. It was just totally free here. However, if you had to send somebody to Sydney to a specialist, a pediatrician particularly, it's a real diagnostic conundrum, then it had to come out of the checkoff.
Okay.
So the physician had to make some arrangement to pay for it rather than the patient paying for it.
Really?
So it was inhibitory. You didn't want to send too many of your patients off to see somebody else because it would cost you. And the same for drugs. The drugs were included in the checkoff, and then the drugs were negotiated every few years which ones were included.
Okay.
So the common ones, the narcotics and the painkillers and the antibiotics, cough syrups, the few antihypertensives that were available, there's really only one, they were all included in the dollar a week, $1.25 a week. So the doctors became their own dispensers. For the drugs that were included, you would buy in bulk and spend Saturday night transferring cough syrup from a 10-gallon jug to a 3-ounce bottle. Slapping a label on it, screwing on the top, and you took them with you wherever you went. So the trunk of a doctor's car was always full of medications.
How often would you have prescribed something that wasn't covered?
It was not uncommon, actually. We did write a fair number of scripts. There was great competition among the druggists for your scripts. They would supply the checkoff doctors with free prescription pads with their logo on the back so that the patient would take them to their drugstore. So there was a lot of competition. So we did, the drugs were getting fewer and fewer on the checkoff, and more the patient had to pay for them, and that was a source of great discontent among the patients. As new drugs came in, the doctors became more and more resistant to including them on the checkoff because it was money out of their pocket to do
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the salary, the average salary for a doctor in the Chekhov when you were there, was much different for someone outside in a different town that worked for fee-for-service?
I would say it wasn't a great deal different, but that the doctor working in the Chekhov probably worked twice as hard for his money.
Okay, for the same amount.
Or maybe even three times as hard.
Would you have seen exclusively patients insured under the system, or what would you say would be the percentage of...
In the early years of the Chekhov, it was mostly Chekhov patients. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, the mines were closing, and a smaller and smaller fraction of the patients were Chekhov.
Okay.
And more and more were on the Chekhov. That was a big difference. So I was there as locums, filling in for one of the Chekhov doctors who was away.
What year was that in?
I was there off and on in the 60s. 63, okay. I think, was the first time I went. And the I got paid for doing an appendix. And it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. I mean, the amount of money that I got paid. It was Great West Life that the family had. They weren't mine. Got $125. $125 in those days could buy you the best suit of clothes that you could get in the country, plus a pair of shoes and a nice new tie. Of course, for an appendectomy now, you couldn't buy the shoes. Probably couldn't buy the tie. The surgery was well paid, and when you did get to do it off the Chekhov, it was extraordinarily rewarding. So you kind of knew that people who weren't doing most of their work on the Chekhov were starting, the differentials were starting to widen, that people were, doctors were getting better paid elsewhere. But they weren't badly paid. They certainly made a lot more money than the miners did. So I think they probably did reasonably well. When Medicare came in, their incomes tripled overnight. It's just unbelievable. They went from a reasonable income to untold riches. They couldn't believe, because they didn't stop their work habits. They still saw three times as many people as anybody else, and it got them into trouble because the mining towns had a reputation. The young doctors didn't want to go there. So they, even when they could recruit, they had trouble getting new people in, and so they were still understaffed, and so they still had 6,000 and 7,000 people on their practices, which is twice to three times what the average practice would have. And they still went full out. So the Maritime or MSI was constantly sending people down to investigate these doctors. How could you? How can you be making this amount of money? And then they'd follow these fellows around for a few days and say, "Look, this is ridiculous. I've got more to do in my life than work 20 hours a day. You want to work that way? Good luck." They'd come back and tell MSI, "Look, you have to pay them. You're never going to get anybody else to work the way they're working."
Well.
And that's because they had been inured to it all the years that they were there. The miners made unbelievable demands on them.
Really?
They felt they owned them. And there were lots of nice people there and so on who were quite decent and humble. But there were a lot who were saying, with the attitude, they were paying your salary. You better bloody come when you were called. You'd get calls, ridiculous calls. They'd call in the middle of the night for trivial things. And if you didn't show up, there was hell to pay.
Really?
I suppose it's the kind of mix we've got today, because the patients don't pay anything today. A lot of them feel that they're old. Medical care is a right, and the miners felt that way. Some of them, anyway.
Who was covered under their subscription?
Themselves, their families.
Just immediate family?
Well, it was supposed to be just immediate family, but it was anybody who lived in the house, so often it was the grandparents.
Okay.
And visitors from Boston, and family pets. And
do you know what would happen if a minor retired? Would they still be...
They were covered.
They were covered.
Yeah, that was part of the...
And would that be the same for a family if the minor in the family died?
I don't know what happened there. I can't remember. I don't think so. I think if the minor died, the family was in trouble.
Do you know, did all the minors pay the same fee? Or would it depend on your family?
No, they all paid the same.
Bachelor or not? Mm. Well.
Because it didn't just cover the doctor's fees, it covered the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it covered your access to the system. So, as far as I recall, everybody paid, every minor got checked off $1 a quarter a week when I was there.
Okay. Was that the only source of funds for the hospitals, or?
Well, they billed for patients who weren't on the checkup.
Okay, yeah.
Usually about a third of the towns were not minors. And they got government funding and so forth. And the Catholic hospitals were run by orders, Sisters of Charity, Sisters of St. Martha, and they had other sources of funds.
Okay. Did how did the hospitals themselves compare to other hospitals? I know you said that some of the equipment mightn't have been...
Well, as today was then, that the hospitals are only good as their medical staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospitals don't initiate anything. They respond to
mm-hmm.
medical staff requests, and there are exceptions to that. Administrators who have a great deal of insight or foresight, but the numbers of those around in my time were pretty limited. And if the doctors didn't want it, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was nobody at the administrative level pressing to improve. A little different over in Waterford. The sister who ran the hospital over there was had been elsewhere and knew that the standards needed. Upgraded, and as I recall, did press for improvements in medical staff, but I didn't detect any of that in place.
Okay. How would you have changed or improved on the system, or do you think you could have improved on it?
Oh, I think the system had the seeds of its own inadequacies, and any system like that. Which is essentially a closed system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it would work. Panel medicine, checkoff systems are, of course, in vogue in many places. England still has a system, but it doesn't apply to the hospitals. It's to the practice, so, to general practice. So I think if the hospitals and in-hospital care had been excluded, that many of the inadequacies, both early and late, wouldn't have occurred or
mm-hmm.
would have been looked after. The problem, of course, is that this is a philosophical argument. The separation of hospitals in England is a consequence of long-standing competition and animosity between physicians, the town, and the gown. The physicians, university-based and hospital-based physicians. And that separation was a way of getting around the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that the hospital-based doctors did not want to be in the same group as general practitioners that felt they were, they'd gone on from general practice. Everybody was a GP, and then they'd gone on, got further training and so on. And in Canada, the systems did not evolve that way. A great many of the GPs were their own specialists. They were doing surgery, or they were doing cardiology, or whatever. And the separation, and they staffed the hospitals so that even today in small towns, general practitioners staff the emergency room on a rotational basis. So the separation was not felt to be a good thing in Canada, whereas in England it was contrived and forced by the hospital doctors, this separation. So it evolved differently here, and as a consequence, I'm not sure that it would have been perceived by either the profession or the hospitals or the boards as being, in quotes, a good thing to have hospital-based people and community-based doctors paid differently. I don't think that would have flown. So I'm not sure that that even if you had been able to convince them that that was a deficiency which was leading to ever widening disparity between medical care in the mining towns and the adjacent communities, I don't think they would have changed it. The idea of excluding the GP from the hospital was a non-starter. And even in Halifax here, the GPs nominally are not excluded. In effect, they are, but there is a section of general practice, and there are staff appointed to the hospital who are GPs. But I suppose it's within my lifetime that the GP has been gradually excluded from the hospital. And it wouldn't have flown, I don't think. Even though it was the problem, I don't think it would have flown. And there are probably other ways to get around it. The insurance system that came in broke it up. That is, the doctors were then paid fee for service on an individual service basis. So that completely broke down the checkoff system. But the miners didn't like it. The miners pined for their old system where they were in control and they negotiated the terms of service and so on. So obviously for them, a lot was lost. I know what they missed. I think what they got in exchange was far better, but I don't think they felt that way. Especially if you're a union negotiator and you're not sick, the intricacies of provision of neonatal care are lost on you. The fact that you could hire and fire the doctor at will was far more important an issue than whether the quality of the care in the newborn nursery was as good as it was in Sydney. So I think there were problems there.
How did they end up picking which doctor they went with? Did they just go with whoever their family went with, or
the way that the new doctor coming into town had to persuade miners to leave whoever they were with and go with the new doctor. It had the benefit, of course, that if somebody was particularly bad, they'd lose their practice very quickly because everybody would switch.
So it wouldn't be arranged between the doctors, it would be through the miners?
No. Now the physicians could preempt that a bit by recruiting somebody to help in a practice or to be the supernumerary, and they pay them out of the, and then gradually they transfer patients. They discuss with the patients, would you mind, Joe saw you, or can I switch your account to Joe, and so on. So they could incorporate people, but there's a lot of resistance to that. It caused long-term animosities. In the beginning, all the doctors were solo. great deal of persuasion to get them to come together.
Mm-hmm.
There was a move, one or two of the six in town really worked hard. So, you know, we could save a lot of money if we have a single building and we have offices and we can share the registration and the nurses. It was an economic argument.
Mm-hmm.
Plus we can buy our own building, whereas single-handedly we can't.
Mm-hmm.
And the upshot of it was is the same as the as you would have predicted, same as happened with the amalgamation of the four churches to make up the United Church. They ended up with five churches instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. The practitioners who came from the adjacent suburbs of Glace Bay kept their offices open despite having an office in the new building.
Oh, really?
They kept their offices open. And
would they see each other's patients sometimes if, like, cover
yeah,
each other?
They would cover. They would. So that made a big difference
mm-hmm.
in their life. That lifestyle plus sharing the costs of practice as the numbers of minors went down and the amount of money coming in got less, I think had more effect than because there was a lot of animosity.
Mm-hmm.
Because you knew when you went there that the others were conspiring to keep you out. And I don't think they ever got over that.
Mm-hmm.
But, even when they were all friends and all practicing together, in the back of their minds, they knew those SOBs had kept me out for 2 years or 3 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I have any more questions. Is there anything else you...
No, but you get a lot more information from Joe, who
mm-hmm.
was... I wasn't involved in the nuts and bolts of it. I was practicing in it, so I could look at it as an outsider, but Joe was actually instrumental in its administration, its negotiations.
I'm also meeting with Dr. Steele, Bernie Steele, next week, on Wednesday.
Now, Bernie's... involvement is really interesting because Bernie not only worked in New Waterford,
mm-hmm.
But he was also up in Inverness, which was quite different. It was really different than the mining town, the big mining towns. It's a much smaller place, and the checkoff worked quite differently there.
Was it a voluntary checkoff? In
no.
Sydney, I think it was voluntary.
I think it was mandatory.
It was mandatory.
I think the miners negotiated that. See, in the mines, the unions were really tough in the mining towns. I think towards the end of it, in the mining towns, I think there was some attempt made to open the checkoff to non-miners
mm-hmm.
to try to keep the thing going. I'm not sure that ever got anywhere. To say all the people I practice with are all gone.
Mm-hmm.
But Bernie will remember. But Bernie, looked, again, he was only 2 years, I think.
Was he?
1 year in the Waterford, maybe 2 years in Inverness. So he would be like Joel, who spent his whole practice life in it. And Nakwe,
mm-hmm.
I talked to him for an hour about it. Big gaps in his memory
mm-hmm.
about this. I'm not sure Mackie is as sharp as he used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he thinks Joe will give you a much better.
Mm-hmm. I'm also meeting with a miner who, I think he's in his 80s now, but he spent his whole life, he started working when he was 13, so he spent his whole life in the mine, and it'll be interesting to see how his
yeah,
is different.
We'll have to see if we can find... get the history of it. It's probably in the library. There's a lot of stuff in the library.